I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In the 2012 election here in the state of Wisconsin, the Democratic Party won about 54% of the vote statewide, but just 39% of seats in the Assembly. In other states, the situation is different. The Democrats have changed maps so that they have an advantage, although the advantage in Wisconsin on the part of Republicans is very large, and it has been said that Wisconsin may be the most gerrymandered state in the country. On July 8th, 12 plaintiffs from Wisconsin filed lawsuit asking a federal court to throw out the state legislative assembly district map, calling the line drawing process secretive and partisan, and the maps unconstitutional for overly advantaging one party. And a call was issued by the Supreme Court in previous cases for a standard to measure how much partisan gerrymandering is allowable and shows how Wisconsin's map is put together. Well, it turns out that recently, on December 17, the Wisconsin Democrats who were part of this lawsuit were told they could proceed with a lawsuit that challenges the redistricting plan as an example of extreme partisan gerrymandering. Three federal judges found that the group had met legal standards to argue its case. So how do we define gerrymandering? How is it achieved? How is it used? How has it been used historically? Is it true that Wisconsin is the most or one of the most gerrymandered states in the country? What about the issue of fairness? What about minority votes? We have a lot to talk about this hour. And if you're going to go to a different system, what system would you go to? Will all of this need to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court eventually? I think several of our guests would like to see it go that far because they see a system that is quite unfair. We have three guests with us. Joining us by phone is Peter Earle. Peter is a Milwaukee attorney and lead lawyer for the plaintiffs in the redistricting lawsuit, and he's been involved in previous litigation over the maps. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello, Kathleen. You're welcome, and I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here as well. Also joining us in our studios is Sachin Chetta, and Sachin is a spokesperson for the Fair Elections Project. They are have been formed to promote nonpartisan redistricting. He's also a partner at Nation Consulting. He works with corporate, labor, political, and nonprofit clients on strategic planning, management, messaging, and government and public relations. He's had a long career in public service. He was an aide to Governor Jim Doyle, and more than 20 years of political and issue campaign experience. Sachin, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Thanks so much for having me and for discussing this issue.
Yeah, and later on we'll speak with a person who has put together an alternative to the way things are done now, and we'll examine that and see if it's a way to go. Peter, let's start with you. Is Wisconsin the most gerrymandered state in the nation?
I can say with empirical certainty that compared to every other legislative redistricting plan in the United States between 1972 and the year 2000, not one single plan anywhere in the United States so severely skewed the votes in favor of one party against the other party than the Wisconsin plan. We are absolutely the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the worst in the country, we are the worst in history.
And you would like, am I right, to have the U.S. Supreme Court take up this issue? There are other states that are gerrymandered, maybe not as dramatically as Wisconsin, but there are other states where Democrats have an advantage.
Yes, that's correct. I think Rhode Island jumps out as an example of that. Massachusetts, there are a number of states. And historically, if you go way back, it was the Democrats who did the most egregious gerrymandering in earlier years. It's only been in the last couple of decades where the Republicans have emerged as the champions of that type of effort.
Mm-hmm. And the lawsuit, tell me when it was filed and where it stands right now, Peter.
Okay, well, it was filed this summer. I believe it was July this summer. And we survived a motion to dismiss. And I want to, Kathleen, I just want to focus on that for 1 second.
Sure.
If I may. Since 1986, no lawsuit challenging the partisan gerrymandering of legislative districts has survived a motion for to dismiss.
Hmm.
The first time since then, because the courts have really had to wrestle with this idea, and it's a complex idea, this idea of how much partisan gerrymandering is okay and how much is not okay. I mean, everybody, I think, any reasonable person would agree that when legislators gather around the legislative process to draw their maps for the next 10 years, that there's going to be a certain amount of advantage seeking,
sure,
by incumbents and so forth. So, and the Supreme Court has recognized that historically. So some manipulation of the maps for political advantage is obviously okay. The challenge the court has had is how much is not okay. At what point does the process cross the line? And this is a challenge that's been out there. It was first recognized by the Supreme Court in a case called Karcher back in 1983, Karcher v. Daggett. And it was the first time it was ever mentioned. It was a case in which, in a concurrence, Justice Stevens said he thought that that case should be decided on the basis of partisan gerrymandering, and instead the court decided it on the basis of one person, one vote. And then a few years later, in 1986, in the Bandemir case, the Supreme Court again visited the question. And what was significant about that case was that the court wrestled with this idea whether partisan gerrymandering represents a political question, or whether it is what lawyers call justiciable, a justiciable controversy, a controversy that is amenable to resolution by a court. And in order for a controversy to be justiciable, that it needs to have some kind of a metric that measures precisely what the standards are.
Mm-hmm.
Laws generally have standards. I guess we have standards for almost everything except, I guess, obscenity, which I guess we recognize when we see it.
Right.
And that standard won't fly with gerrymandering. So that's kind of where we are. And if you think about this for a second, there is no process more important in a democracy, and certainly no process more important in the United States and more fundamental to our freedoms than the ability to govern ourselves, to participate meaningfully in the electoral process, select our representatives, and those are the representatives that make the laws. The courts, conservatives on the courts, you hear this all the time from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, we must defer to the legislature. They make the policy choices. The whole idea that courts would defer to the lawmaking process of a legislature is that the legislature is an effective representative of the people, mm-hmm, and expresses the people's will. However, if the legislature doesn't represent the will of the people and that process becomes distorted, then the legislative choices are not reflective of that will. And there is, if the gerrymandering is so bad, then there is no recourse to a remedy. Because the idea here is, in a political question, is that if the legislature steps out on a limb and passes a very stupid law, for example, we've had proposals for about public records in Wisconsin, you know, there's a public outcry, and the legislators presumably would change their mind. And if they don't change their mind or they don't adhere to the public will, then they lose the next election. That is the idea, is that the electoral process would be self-correcting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that is what the insidious aspect of partisan gerrymandering is, because it results in the statistic that you cited at the beginning of this program. There were 186,133 more votes for Democratic Assembly people than there were for Republican people in 2012. Yet they got 60 seats, and the Democrats got 39 seats.
Mm-hmm.
Now that election occurred in with a what we call a 13% efficiency gap in favor of the defendants. I mean, defendants in favor of the Republicans. We think we've come up with a metric that will give the court a reliable way to measure how much is too much.
Mm-hmm. Sachin, what about one person, one vote? Don't elections have to adhere to that? Is that written somewhere and it's a part of the American electoral process?
Absolutely. Now, I want to say for the record, I'm not an attorney and Peter is, so
right,
he can speak to the law better than me. But, you know, the vision here, and Peter said it, is that our votes are going to be meaningful, and that when you go to an election, what is happening is that elected officials are standing before the people, and the people are making a decision. Do we want to keep this person? Do we want to elect somebody new? And it's on the basis of their actions. If their actions are disconnected completely from what happens in the election, right, if they can take an action and they're not worried about whether they're going to get reelected or not, then they don't have to be responsive to the people.
Hmm.
And, you know, one person, one vote is very similar in that that if you have, you know, districts that had, 50,000 people, another district that had 20,000 people, they only had to be accountable to very few people, right? And there's other standards the court has put forward, right, that we want communities of interest to be able to elect people together. We want racial minorities and traditionally underrepresented people to have a chance to elect their representatives. You know, we have all these civil rights, both cases and laws, that say that we can't, you know, have a map that intentionally excludes people, which, you know, maps did for more than a century. They just excluded people and said you either can't vote or your votes aren't going to be meaningful. And so in a series of cases and political decisions, you know, obviously the heyday of the civil rights era in the 1960s, the court said we're going to have a different set of standards. We've seen the laws that Congress has passed, and not only do racial minorities need to be included, but every vote needs to count equally. And so when we talk about the modern era, right, when districts had to become equal in population, which the first time that was kind of universal across the country was after the 1970 census and the 1971 redistricting. So in the 1972 election, so you really started to see the legislatures of the various states have to be responsive to the people in a very different way. And in Wisconsin, we were able to draw fair maps or have the courts draw fair maps because we had split party control, right? So in 1971, the legislature had Republicans and Democrats, and you know, you had a governor of one party, and they came together and they agreed on a compromise map that was fair. And then in 1981, 1991, and 2001, because there was split control, the courts ended up having to draw the maps. And again, they were fairly fair, and you could have competitive elections that were meaningful, and control of the legislature would go back and forth. Now you have a situation after the 2010 election, the 2011 redistricting, is one party for the first time in modern political American history or Wisconsin history drew all the maps, right? You had a Republican governor. Both houses of the legislature were Republicans. They had an extremely corrupt process. It was secretive. They forced members of their own party to sign secrecy agreements. The federal court rebuked them for the process that they used, but on the basis of, you know, the other standards, whether it's racial equity or communities of interest, the maps adhere to the standards. But what they didn't adhere to is a standard of fairness to both parties, to members of the public who vote for both parties. And so, as Peter said, we're trying to put forward now a standard that the court can say, look, to me, it's just like obscenity. You know it when you see it, but the court needs to have an objective standard. They've asked for there to be an objective standard in previous cases. And so we think this efficiency gap metric that Peter mentioned is a great metric to use to say, let's look at this map. Is it too partisan? If it's too partisan, maybe there's a reason for that. The state has a chance to kind of justify why they've made certain decisions. But at least the people will have a chance to choose their elected officials instead of elected officials choosing their voters, which is the system we have now in Wisconsin.
Peter, how are things gerrymandered? What happened?
Well, I guess, if I may, the process, the test that we're proposing here is a three-part test. The first part is there has to be the intent to burden the constitutional rights of the other side. There has to be an intent to treat the adherents of one political party differently and skew the value of their vote in a negative fashion. There has to be an intent to do that. That's the stuff of subjective evidence that you have to present to the court. And in this case, Sachin has already described some of that, the egregious secrecy with which the legislative process was undertaken. Here, the legislative process was literally moved out of the Capitol and across the street into the law offices of Michael Best, where a conference room set up next to the office of Eric McLeod, the lead lawyer for the Republicans. And everybody who had access to that room had to sign a secrecy agreement. And even if they signed a secrecy agreement, they only had very limited access. Republican legislators who signed that agreement, and all of them did, could only see their map. And they promised in that secrecy agreement not to talk about that, not to show it to anybody. They weren't even allowed to leave the room with it. Mm-hmm. So that's only part of it. And this was all cloaked under a completely bogus allegation of attorney-client privilege. And so you have that secrecy, but you also have one of the country's top political scientists, statisticians, hired by the Republicans to, months before the remap process was to was to be put before the people of the legislature. He sat in a room and figured out a metric to predict what the partisan performance of each of the districts they were proposing was going to be. And so they knew exactly what the product was going to be here, the political product that would yield 60 seats versus 39 seats in an election in 2012. They predicted that outcome with statistical precision before that map was ever even presented to the legislature for a final vote. So this is all evidence of intent. Now, the question then becomes, so now we've proven intent, and interestingly, at this point, the defendants are not really defending on the part of intent, the presence of intent or the absence of intent. The court in the Baldus case, which was the case that that was filed over the principally over the question of racial gerrymandering against Latinos, kind of talked about that and said that they thought that the denial of intent was laughable, is what's the language that they used. So that's the first element. The second element is, did that intent result in a tangible burden on the voting rights or the electoral rights of Democratic adherents? And that's where the efficiency gap comes in. It measures that. What the efficiency gap does is it's the difference between the respective wasted votes of each party divided by the total number of votes in the election. Now, I'll explain that. All right? So how do you – I'm coming back to the question you asked, which is how does gerrymandering happen? Right? And the way gerrymandering happens is there's two simultaneous things that are done. There's what we call packing, and there's what we call cracking. Packing is where you take the adherents of one party and you squeeze them together into overly concentrated district. So if you have a district of 80% Democrats, for example, 40% of the Democrat votes in that district are going to be wasted votes. They're votes that are not necessary to the outcome of the election. Mm-hmm. The Republicans voting in that district would only waste 20% of the votes. Right? I mean, the number of wasted votes are very small. And then, after you've done as much packing as you can, you then crack the remaining Democrats. In other words, you put them in districts where there's a Republican majority, and a significant Republican majority, perhaps a 55-60% Republican majority, and where the statistics are reliable enough that those cracked districts will likely result in a Republican victory, even in Democratic wave elections. Right? So then the Democrats are wasting all of those votes. So when you add up all the wasted votes for the Republicans and all the wasted votes for the Democrats, it ends up happening that the Democrats have a huge burden in terms of more wasted votes than the Republicans, then they can't ever win. The whole game will have been rigged. The process will have been skewed in favor of the Republicans, and we can measure that to the point of 13% in Wisconsin. So in effect, you could say that Democrats have 13% of the electoral weight of Republicans. I mean, have 13% less.
How does minority voting figure into all of this, Sachem, and how does it figure into redistricting, and how will the voting rights of minorities need to be taken into account when redistricting?
There are lots of different standards, and I would actually defer to Peter on this question, and I know you want to go back and forth with Trudeau. He's really an expert on the Voting Rights Act and what's required. So let me throw that to him and maybe come back to me with another question.
Okay.
Minority voting is protected by both the Constitution and the Voting Rights Act, and we had an example of Republican abuse of that in this last gerrymandering. But it's a separate kind of a thing. There they did not create districts that allowed the Latino community to elect its own official, its own people of its own choices.
Mm-hmm.
Choices. So we challenged that under the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and won. The voting rights of minorities is, in the context of partisan gerrymandering, a factor that must be considered in how you draw the maps. You have to draw the maps that allow that allow for minority communities to elect representatives of their choice. And so that's kind of a front-end consideration in the partisan gerrymandering process. But that's not part of what is at stake here in Wisconsin.
All right, let's welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in, and here's how you reach us if you'd like to be a part here. We also have a lot of Facebook comments. We're talking about gerrymandering, and we had the whole situation laid out by Peter at the top of the show, but essentially, if you're just tuning us in the 2012 election, Democratic Party won about 54% of the vote statewide, 39% of seats in the Assembly. In other states, it was the other way around, although not as dramatically as here in the state of Wisconsin. How did this happen? Can legislature that had one-party control and it was done secretively? Our guests this hour involved in a lawsuit on behalf of Democratic voters here in the state of Wisconsin, and it has been deemed recently that the lawsuit has merit. It can go ahead. They are asking a federal court to throw out the state legislative assembly district map, saying that the line drawing process was secretive and partisan, and the map's unconstitutional. They overly advantage one party. Our guest believes that this could be a major election issue and would like the Supreme Court to take this up. And I understand, Sachem, let's give this to you because I'm sure that you have thought about it, that the Supreme Court, because this affects other states in different ways, that the Supreme Court, you would like for them to really take on this whole issue on a national level, right?
Right. So there's a couple pieces to that. One is that redistricting cases have a very unique process. And so while a normal federal trial, you'd have a trial court with one judge, and then you'd have an appellate court, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and then it would go to the Supreme Court. So it's a three-step kind of drawn-out process. Redistricting cases are automatically put into a very compressed two-step process where they immediately go to a three-judge panel at the trial court level. And if there's appeal on any issue that can be appealed, it immediately goes to the Supreme Court. And there's not an intermediate step. So they can move the cases through the system a little bit faster. Obviously, people need to know what the maps are. So elections can be held usually every 2 years for the assembly. So that's one piece in terms of the process. But big picture, we think this is a national problem. Now, we think Wisconsin is an egregious example. But there's also other egregious examples. And Peter mentioned Rhode Island, for example. Rhode Island is a state where there are just a handful of Republicans even in the legislature because it's so gerrymandered by Democrats. And so we don't think this is a problem where only Republicans are doing it. We think this is a problem where here in Wisconsin, Republicans have done something that is bad for democracy. It's bad for people's ability to elect their representatives. But in other states, the other party might have done that. And we want there to be a national nonpartisan standard, right, that voters should have the right to choose their elected officials, no matter what party they're from. We're not trying to advantage one party through this lawsuit or another. We're trying to set a national standard. And the way a national standard gets set is, win or lose, you have the Supreme Court kind of weigh in so that the result of the case isn't just limited to that one place, but that there's an actual constitutional standard put in place. And, our view is that the Supreme Court wants to set a standard on this issue. Now, there's some judges or some justices who don't think partisan gerrymandering should be justiciable, and they think it should be left to the political process because for whatever reason, right? I mean, I kind of have my own views for why they think that. But a majority of the Supreme Court, through various concurrences and dissents and other opinions in other cases, five of the nine sitting Supreme Court justices have said that they do believe partisan gerrymandering exists. They believe it can be found unconstitutional, but they want to define a standard. And so what's great about this case, and Peter mentioned earlier, this case got past a motion to dismiss for the first time, I think, in almost 30 years. We've seen a federal redistricting case based on partisan gerrymandering do that. And that's quite a moment. And it happened. It wasn't a political decision, right? You have a three-judge panel. It was unanimous. There were three different presidents of different parties who nominated those judges. They come from varying legal and political backgrounds. Mm-hmm. But they said unanimously this case should proceed, that we're making an argument that at least should be argued. And now there's a couple of more steps. Hopefully we'll get to a trial and we'll be able to kind of lay out the record of what happened here in Wisconsin. and why it should be kind of the test case for why this type of behavior should be found unconstitutional, and provide the standard so that other maps can be judged on an objective basis.
Phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guest is Sachin Chetta. He's a spokesperson for Fair Elections Project. They were formed to promote nonpartisan redistricting. Peter Earle is a Milwaukee attorney and the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in the redistricting lawsuit. And later we'll be speaking with a City of Milwaukee programmer who is a software developer behind a program, Auto Redistrict, which takes human bias out of redistricting. Obviously, this whole conversation begs the question of what is a better way to do this that is fair, is John's idea fair? Well, we'll be with you in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Caleb in Manitowoc, our first caller for you. Hi, Caleb.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to address more of a geographical point to this. I know to a lower extent, like race, religion, and wealth are kind of grouped in specific areas, but as a broader urban versus rural, I know that the two different groups generally have their own interests and issues they may vote for. But to keep districts fair would be to split, in which case you'd have one representative representing varying interests, or to make it more compact would be to stack the votes, which would make it more, the less effective. So I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Sure. Sachin?
Well, so, you know, there's an argument that's made, and this may be similar to what you're saying, that, you know, Democrats tend to congregate in urban areas and Republicans tend to be in suburban and more rural areas. And so the natural, you know, Peter talked about packing and cracking. And the argument is made, especially by the Republican leadership in the legislature, that the packing and cracking is natural. And you, when you draw fair maps and you use simple lines, that you simply just force Democrats to have higher, you know, margins because they're packed into these smaller districts. And I just want to say that it simply just isn't true. It's something that they allege. There's, you know, a little bit of that, but we have an efficiency gap in Wisconsin in the last two elections that's averaged 13%. And it's probably more likely that the natural efficiency gap coming from that issue is much, much lower. In fact, the plaintiffs have put forward a demonstration map that shows that you can address all the other issues that we were talked about, communities of interest, you know, racial fairness, one person, one vote, all the standards that are currently required, and we think that the Constitution does require partisan gerrymandering to also be not in place. But you can draw a map, and the demonstration map has a efficiency gap of around 2%. The reality is that we can have fair maps. We've had fair maps in Wisconsin for 50 years until this last election. There's really no reason to suggest that we should treat one group of people less fairly than we treat another group of people. And that's really, you know, basically they're saying, look, you know, we would want to treat Democrats and Republicans fairly, but Democrats choose to live in urban areas, so we're not going to treat them fairly. And it really is kind of a nonsensical argument from my perspective. What we need to do is make sure that elections are meaningful and that voters can choose their elected officials. And there's really no doubt when you look at the data and you use common sense that that's not what the system in Wisconsin does. And it leads to a more extreme set of decision making. Because when you don't have accountability in general elections, you tend to push voters into accountability in primary elections. We're seeing that all around the country. There's partisan gerrymandering is on the rise around the country. Wisconsin happens to be the worst example of many bad examples. So we think that there is a good way to do it. A way that's constitutionally sound, a way that's fair to the people, and absolutely, rural interests still need to be represented, urban interests still need to be represented, but we're not talking about electing representatives that have split constituencies. We're talking about elected representatives that have diverse constituencies, and actually, that's a good thing because if all of the people of Wisconsin have representatives that have to understand different perspectives, then hopefully, we're going to have elected officials make better decisions.
Along the same lines, here's a Facebook comment. Peter, Tim says the majority of Democrats live in Menominee County, Dane County, and Milwaukee County, and this is not a result of gerrymandering.
Well, you know, this comment is I think highlights what will probably be a major focus of the litigation as we go to trial. The state has, in fact, asserted that gerrymandering is the product of the natural political geography of the state of Wisconsin, as opposed to the intent of the map drawers.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the response to that is twofold. The first, I guess, and most precise response is that the actual statistical data analyzed by the most competent professors of political science, who are the top statisticians in the world, is that when they look at this and they conclude that in Wisconsin, Republicans are clustered at just as concentrated a fashion as are Democrats. And that is the important statistic. The fact is, yes, there are more Democrats in Milwaukee County than there are in Waukesha County.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there are also more Republicans in Waukesha County than there are in Milwaukee County. So you know, the clustering that exists, it's for, in Wisconsin is a very polarized state. The collar counties around Milwaukee are very highly concentrated Republican areas.
Yes.
So the political geography, the bottom line is that the political geography of Wisconsin does not explain this gerrymander. And the second aspect of this is that we have very clear, almost indisputable evidence that the Republicans who drew this map intended it to be this way. They tested it statistically. They drew it in secrecy. They calculated what their advantage was going to be, and they basically built it into the cake, if you will. It's a combination of those two things: the intent to have this partisan gerrymandering effect, and the documentation that the gerrymandering effect exists and is not, in fact, the result of the natural political geography of the state of Wisconsin.
Let's go to Al in Milwaukee. Hi, Al.
Hi. I'm sure neither party probably has considered this, but for those of us who belong to neither party, isn't it a violation of our right to have districts drawn by political party bias?
Well, I mean, we're arguing that political party bias shouldn't be a part of the system, right? So I don't want to suggest that we're trying to give advantage to one party or the other. As I said, this case in Wisconsin is filed by Democrats because Democrats are the ones whose rights are primarily being violated. And in a state like Rhode Island or Massachusetts, we're hoping to bring a case that would be brought by Republicans because it's their rights who are being violated by partisan gerrymandering. In either case, you still have to have candidates who can get to a majority in any particular district. And so I recognize that the system doesn't necessarily account for making it easier for people who can't build a majority in any district. And maybe that'll change, right? We have a two-party system, and I think there's lots of good people who are working to build a system that has three or more parties. And that isn't necessarily affected by this. But the other thing that I'll say that I think is important is bias works against the interests of all voters. In fact, we've had a lot of discussion in the Fair Elections Project about how the partisan gerrymandering in favor of Republicans actually hurts Republicans in some way, because Republicans are not a monolithic group. They're a diverse group. And if you are someone who is opposed to the views on a particular policy issue of the leadership, who can't really be held accountable because there's no chance they're going to lose a majority if they act in an immoderate way, then your issues are being affected. In fact, our group, the Fair Elections Project, is co-chaired by two former majority leaders, the former Republican Majority Leader Dale Schultz and the former Democratic Majority Leader Tim Cullen, both of whom were seen as moderates by their caucuses. I don't think Dale was always seen as a moderate, but definitely at the end of his career. And I think Tim was always seen as kind of a moderate in his caucus. And they kind of, you know, became odd people out of each of their respective caucuses. And so, you know, when you have a constitutional system that prizes incrementalism, but yet we've seen radical change in Wisconsin, you know, I think those who are students of constitutional history know that that's outside of the way that America Americans have really seen, that it's been very rare to see this type of radical change, and especially to see this type of radical change when there isn't a public outcry for it, right? There's no public outcry for slashing the University of Wisconsin system or changing the open record system or turning away federal Medicaid money or turning away money to support a train. There's no those aren't things that have, you know, massive popular support. Those are things that a political majority that is not driven by a popular majority is making for political reasons, and it's disconnected from what the people say that they want on all of those issues. The last thing I'll say, and I want to be respectful of the caller, is we do have a system in which right now the legislature is responsible, right? The legislature is given the responsibility to draw a map, and obviously the governor can sign the bill after the legislature passes a map through an act of legislation. And we're not actually arguing that the system should change. There are good people who are out there arguing. In fact, our co-chairs are arguing for you know, for example, a nonpartisan redistricting commission. The lawsuit doesn't address the process. What they address is the outcome. What they address, what happens, and whether the map is fair. And if we win this case, and we're hoping to win this case, the expectation is that the court will remand the responsibility back to the legislature. Now, the legislature may choose not to draw a fair map, in which case it would come back to the courts, as it did in 1981, 1991, and 2001, where the legislature couldn't come to a conclusion on a map, and so therefore it was thrown to the courts because somebody had to do it. But we're not trying to change the process. What we're trying to change is the standard, so that votes that every vote counts. That's the goal. And then you know, there's a separate process, and it's really a more political process where the people and the legislature hopefully will decide that we should make it a nonpartisan process, as other states have done. We don't have an initiative process here in Wisconsin. The voters can't pass a petition trying to get that on the ballot like has happened in other states. We don't have any confidence that this legislature is willing to put forward a change in the process, because they're very happy that they've baked in control the way Peter said. So we think that the system itself has to change, and hopefully that will create more opportunity for people with diverse political views. But it's not a core part of this particular case.
More phone calls in a moment, and we will, although it is not the focus of this whole hour, we will ask if we were going to change the system, what kind of system would we have? We're going to invite a third guest in the studio who's a City of Milwaukee programmer and software developer. He has a program, Auto Redistrict, which takes human bias out of redistricting. We'll ask him to talk about that and take more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And joining us now in our studio, we are talking about this lawsuit, but it also begs the question, what kind of system should we have that would be one person, one vote, and that would be fair? So we have invited Kevin Boss, a City of Milwaukee programmer and the software developer behind the program Auto Redistrict, to join us in the studio to talk about this. Thank you very much, Kevin, for being with us. Hello.
You're welcome. Hello.
What have you developed and why?
I've developed the program that basically it evaluates maps, like millions of them, hundreds of them a second, and finds the best ones based on a number of criteria, and I've developed to solve the problem of gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm. Maps all over the state of Wisconsin. So what do you mean?
Redistricting proposals, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It evaluates proposals. It generates new proposals based on the results of previous evaluations and just keeps progressively improving it.
And how does it take the human consideration out of consideration, the human gerrymandering out?
Humans don't get to draw any lines at all with the software. Software automatically draws the lines itself and tries different places to put the lines, and each time it scores them and tries to find what works, what makes for the most competitive elections and the most fair elections.
And you have stressed the transparent nature of this program, right?
Yes, it is an open source program and it's free, so anyone can look at the source code and make their own clones of it, essentially, if they want.
Maps created in terms of compactness, tell me what each of these terms means, equal population, and connectedness.
Compactness is just basically, it's circle-like rather than stringy. Equal population, meaning that each district has about the same number of people, so each representative represents the same number of people. Connectedness is that the district isn't over here and also over here, and there's nothing in between.
Mm-hmm. Are there other states that have used this kind of computer programming?
No states do any kind of automated redistricting. They're all hand-drawn.
Why?
I guess computer technology is new, I would say. And I would imagine people don't trust it that much yet, but, like, I don't know why they don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Your program has been criticized for not taking ethnicity into account, that under the Voting Rights Act, minority communities constitute communities of interest who must be able to elect a candidate of choice.
I have since added an ethnicity standard to it. What it does is it makes the elections equally competitive for every ethnicity so that they have, you know, basically equal voting power.
So if people wanted to see how this is done, when it's transparent, it means that I, as a citizen, could somehow access how this is put together.
Yeah, you can look at the source code online and you can download it for yourself and try it out.
Mm-hmm. Peter, do you have a model when, obviously, this has crossed your mind? Peter is gone. Thank you, Peter, for being with us. I meant to thank him. When you have a model in mind of what might be better, does a computer program sound like a good idea to you?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Kevin's done some really interesting work here, and it's something he's been talking about in the community. And computers are a huge part of the solution, but they're also, it's interesting, they've actually been a huge part of the problem. One of the reasons, and I'm not saying that to criticize Kevin's software at all, but one of the reasons we got into the place that we are after the 2011 redistricting is because there was always some element of trying for political advantage, right? If one party anywhere in the country tried to give themselves political advantage, they would draw a map to give themselves political advantage. What happened in 2011 after the 2010 redistricting is computer modeling had gotten so sophisticated that they were able to do it scientifically in a way that had really never been done before, not only in Wisconsin but across the country. And that's basically, you know, you have a tool, this whether it's, you know, Kevin's computer software or somebody else's computer software, and in the hands of the wrong person, they can do a lot of bad with that. Now, what Kevin is saying is great because he wants it to be open source. He doesn't want it to be a secretive process. But that really isn't about necessarily the technology. It's about the rules under which the technology is used. Mm. Those rules are still going to be written by human beings. They're going to be written by the legislature. Both the U.S. and the state constitution require certain actors in the political process, usually the legislature, depending on the state it could change, but usually the legislature, to draw district lines. And so having this tool is great. Now, do I think we can get to the political place where we make a political decision to turn over the drawing of maps to some computer program? I think that's hard because somebody is going to have to still program the computer, right? I mean, it's not – it can never be so automated. As he said, he had to make adjustments to account for ethnicity. Those things haven't been vetted yet in his particular software by academic experts on redistricting. The way that the standard that we're proposing in the lawsuit has been vetted by Professor Mayer of UW-Madison and Professor Jackman of Stanford University and Professor Pildes of New York University. So there's some peer review process in the efficiency gap metric mm-hmm. that Professor Stephanopoulos from the University of Chicago and Eric McGee put forward the standard in an academic paper. It was then, you know, published in a journal after peer review. So we do think that there's some of that work, but the idea that we should take the tools, improve them, put them in the public sphere, let everything be transparent. These are all incredibly important values. Again, we're agnostic, and the lawsuit is agnostic on who should draw the lines. We think the court should decide that this map is unfair, remand the map back, and mm-hmm. then the process will continue. But over time, we do hope that it becomes way more transparent, that the requirement for transparency is put into place, either from a constitutional standard or from a legal standard, and that the expectation of the people is that they're going to have the right to see what's happening, to decide who their own representatives are. And I think for that reason, it's a great step forward.
Yeah, Kevin, what do you say?
I agree. One thing about the software that's elegant, the approach of evaluating new maps, is you can actually put any standard you want into there. You'd have to program the standards in, but the process that it uses allows for any criteria to be used that you want.
Mm-hmm. So when did you start doing this? Was it after the redistricting in 2010? Did it become of concern to you, or have you looked at this for a long time?
It was after the redistricting of 2010 when I saw that it was, like, throughout the country there was a deliberate attempt by Republicans to take control of state legislators so that they could draw the maps.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just Republicans. We've heard Wisconsin is perhaps the most egregious, but we've heard of other states where Democrats have done the same
thing,
right?
Yeah, I have looked at it, and I have seen that there are states that are Democrats that have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was this was like a countrywide effort.
Yeah. And you're going to take this beyond, you hope, the state of Wisconsin, right?
Absolutely. So we've framed the Fair Elections Project as a national campaign. We've got a Wisconsin lawsuit filed. We're actively working both to raise the necessary resources. These lawsuits aren't free, and to identify lawyers, identify plaintiffs in other states. The metric, the efficiency gap metric, is one that can be applied nationally to state legislatures and to even lower level. Partisan seats. You can't apply it in a nonpartisan seat, and a lot of local elections in a state like Wisconsin would be nonpartisan. So we're measuring partisan gerrymandering. There's no way to measure nonpartisan or partisan gerrymandering in a nonpartisan seat. But we do hope to file more lawsuits, and I hope people stay in touch with us through our website at fairelectionsproject.org or through Twitter and Facebook at WI Fair Elections.
Okay, let's go to some more phone calls. Richard in Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for doing what you're doing. I was wondering if you had read the op-ed by Sam Wang in the New York Times, December 8, 2015, called Math Can Save Democracy, in which he takes median and mean and says it's not that complicated. It's, you know, what he called, you know, this is a sixth grade problem on a core test.
Kevin, are you familiar with this?
I haven't read the article, but I agree with the general premise that it is not that complicated. It's not high-level math.
Really?
Yeah.
We're led to believe that it is. This is all convoluted, and it's really hard to figure the whole thing out, et cetera.
Yeah, what I'd say about that is the math may not be that complicated, but constitutional law is complicated, right? Mm-hmm. And what often happens in constitutional law is the balancing of competing interests. So we have a standard, which math is a part of, but not the only part of, around, you know, the rights of minorities. We have a standard around one person, one vote, which is a math problem, right, that districts have to be equal in population. We have a standard around communities of interest, which is pretty subjective, you know, but like we'll give an example that, you know, for 100 years, the city of Beloit had an assembly district that was essentially the city of Beloit, you know, and then depending on the population, it might take a little bit from outside of the city or it might be a little bit less than the city. This last round of gerrymandering split the city of Beloit, you know, almost in half. That's a community of interest. That's a historical problem. Like, why would you do that? Or mm-hmm. splitting Neenah and Menasha, or changing the shape of the Racine and Kenosha districts, which is kind of egregious. That, you know, used to have kind of a Racine County Senate district and a Kenosha County Senate district. Again, not exactly, but generally. And then what the legislature did is they turned districts that had been horizontal on a map and they turned them vertical because they could gain a partisan advantage by doing that, right? So those aren't questions that are easy to see in map without the human observation, right, without using your eyes. And using the history books to say, okay, this isn't how we've done things, right? And those are the kinds of things that federal courts can consider. Those are the kinds of things that legislatures can consider. We absolutely need to use good math in the tools, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of it. The efficiency gap metric is a math metric. But we also, as Peter mentioned, it's not a one-part test, right? It's not an either-or, black or white. Our proposed metric is really, it's a three-part test. A metric is a part of that. But we also have to measure against all these other standards and balance it. On balance, we think what's happened in Wisconsin is egregious, right? The math is egregious, but we also think that the result of it is egregious. And so we think that that subjective process really can, in Wisconsin, not withstand constitutional review. In some other states, it can't. And hopefully we'll have a new standard.
Mm-hmm. Who have you shown this auto redistrict to and who said, ooh, Kevin, I like this idea?
My friend Dave at Urban Milwaukee, my family, basically anyone I could, actually, because I was so excited.
You hope it'll catch on.
I hope it'll catch on.
Yeah. Let's go to Carl in Madison, and we're running short on time, about a minute left. Hi, Carl.
I'll be brief, hopefully.
Okay.
I was surprised when California went to fair redistricting, and I'm wondering if you have any background on what was the motivation behind that? How was that accomplished?
You know, I should be an expert on this, and I'm gonna become one after this call. But I'm not exactly sure how all of these happened, I know that there have been a series of ballot initiatives where the voters in some states have said we want fair redistricting, like in Florida. In some states, the legislature has come together. Sometimes it's a split legislature, so they say, look, it's going to be split anyway. Instead of letting this go to the courts, let's have a nonpartisan commission. Sometimes legislators just do the right thing. We don't see any real hope of that in Wisconsin, the way this legislature and this governor behave, that they're going to suddenly give away their power to do redistricting. They want to maintain total control. If as expected, the legislature remains Republican and a Republican wins the governor's election in 2018, then in the 2021 redistricting, we'll be in the same place that we are now. And instead of 10 years of solid Republican control, we'll be looking at 20 years of solid Republican control. So there's a political solution potentially in the governor's race, but that's not necessarily addressing the fairness question of whether or not there should be a standard around the country. And we're hoping to get there.
Thanks very much for the call, Carl. Thank you both so much. The website, again, you wanted people to go to
the website is fairelectionsproject.org, and the Twitter and Facebook are WI Fair Elections.
Great. Thank you. Sachin Chetta, spokesman for the Fair Elections Project, and also Kevin Baugh, City of Milwaukee programmer and software developer behind the program Auto Redistrict. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Actually, it was KP who did on-air production. Thank you, KP, for doing all of that, and thanks, everybody.